From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Powell. Adolphe Fiche has been re-elected as the French Polynesian president after his party had a second huge majority in the assembly. He claims the voters opted for his Tempura Hadrianum party because they want humility, stability, and peace. On his re-election, the territorial assembly floor was first given to the other two candidates for the top job, who each was allowed to speak for an hour. Walter Zeifel reports.
After a campaign littered with accusations of cheating, the Tahoeraahoeratira candidate, Geoffrey Salmon, was conciliatory in his tone. Looking around the assembly, he also took stock of the political landscape after the defections and expulsions which had decimated his Tahoeraahoeratira party.
Abstentions have been the great winner of this election, and this number, which is growing from one election to the next, should concern us all. In the end, the result of the majority represents a third of registered voters, as it was the case for us in 2013. And today, the problems are the same as yesterday. No real solution has been brought to the employment crisis, the poverty, or the misery which is gaining ground.
Oscar Temaru, the veteran leader of the pro-independence Tavini Huiratira party, took to the podium and planted a United Nations flag. Addressing the assembly first in Tahitian and then in French, he restated his conviction that over time French Polynesia will regain its sovereignty. By using the UN flag, he showed his disapproval of France, which keeps boycotting the decolonization process adopted by the UN General Assembly 5 years ago. He pointed to how his political rival's support of the French nuclear weapons testing regime has changed into joining the lament of its detrimental legacy. In a departure from past elections, Mr. Temaru also delivered a song and read from a letter sent by a supporter.
Probity has to be an absolute prerequisite for the ruling political class, and on this count, I'm proud to have taken part in the march organized by the Tavini Huiratira last April.
Eduard Fritsch defended his team, which included almost a dozen politicians with convictions for corruption. He himself got two sentences in the last term and was ordered to repay more than $80,000 of taxpayers' money.
I want to remind those members wanting to act like judges that justice has passed and been done. I add that under the Constitution, this justice expresses itself on behalf of the people, and that on the 6th of May, that same Maori people has legitimized us.
And he let Mr. Temaru's side know that the decolonization effort had gone nowhere.
Quelle plus-value a apporté cette opération pour notre pays? Rien.
What added value has this brought to our country? None. None. None at all. Even in January 2017, after bad weather caused serious damage, the UN, which is concerned about global warming, ignored us completely.
Eduard Fritsch will present his new government this week. Its challenges are cut out, with a pension reform a priority. Before the election, mass protests and the general strike stopped it, while Mr. Fritsch warned that the scheme will be bankrupt unless he has his way to fix it. This is Walter Zweifel.
The Solomon Islands government says its official position on West Papua won't be made until after provincial consultations. Consultations followed the submissions of a report to the government by the Solomon Islands delegation, which visited Indonesia last month. The delegation, which included civil society workers, visited Indonesia's provinces of Papua and West Papua at the invitation of Jakarta. The Solomon's special secretary on foreign relations, Rens Soar, was one of the government officials who led the delegation. He spoke to Johnny Blades about the purpose of the visit.
Solomon Islands, we are developing a policy on Papua and West Papua, extension of our foreign relations policy. And having gone to Papua and West Papua, we are now seeing a balanced picture.
Before you went, was it unbalanced?
Before we went, we have been listening to the other side of the story. And the story we had always here at that time is there's always human rights abused, there's always fighting for independence, someone is being killed and all that. It's one-sided, all one-sided. When we went, the story was entirely different.
I'm assuming you met with West Papuans themselves, not just the people in the government.
Yeah, we met Papuans, we met civil society representatives. We had informal meetings in Jayapura. We also had informal meetings in Manikwiri, capital of West Papua province. The time is limited, but the informal meetings we had, we consulted a good number of indigenous Melanesians, Papuans in Jayapura, and also Papuans in Manikwiri.
What sort of things were they telling you? Are they concerned about human rights, or are they worried about Indonesian rule?
They are telling us that human rights violation was happening during military rule. Yes, there's no dispute. But since democracy, there has lots of improvements.
There was some concern among Papuan groups that they weren't consulted by your delegation before you went to their homeland. What's your response?
We consulted the government in Jakarta. We consulted the provincial government in Jayapura, in Manikwiri, West Papua. This is an official government-led civil society mission, and all the legal authorities were consulted.
The United Liberation Movement for West Papua, which has links with your country, they voiced disappointment at the way they weren't notified.
The ULMWP, yes, they have strong connections to civil society organizations in Solomon Islands. And to some extent, that strong connection also was with the previous Solomon Islands leadership, government, prime minister. We went with authorization from the current prime minister. Official authorities were notified.
Is it fair to say that under the leadership of Rick Ho, the Solomon Islands government is no longer maintaining the stand that Prime Minister Sogavare had?
That decision is not yet formal. It depends entirely on the report. We did a report when we came back, and we are still doing the consultations on the policy. Once the cabinet endorses the policy, then it becomes the official government position. We're trying to give the government a good picture. Both sides of the coin, we have to tell the government, and the government independently makes that policy decision.
As politicians trade barbs and verbal blows ahead of an election in the Cook Islands, a youth advocacy group says more needs to be done to engage the country's future leaders. The Cook Islands National Youth Council says there is a gulf between politicians and the country's young people, which both sides should work harder to address. Its president, Sini Tera, says there was evidence of a youth parliament held last week where she said MPs had their eyes opened to both the issues they care about and the fire of which they discuss them. She told Jamie Tahana what it is they care about and what can be done.
It was quite interesting, actually. They wanted to see what exactly they were going to do for the youth. Also about bigger issues such as persaining. They had asked questions on that. And also about what they were doing in terms of seeing more women involved in parliaments as well. Whether they had any strategies in place for that. Those were the types of topics that had come up in discussion. We also had broken them up into their own hypothetical opposition and government teams, where they came up with their own names of their parties and slogans, and then they created their own mini manifestos as well.
What did you find in the manifestos? Were the issues they cared about quite different to, I guess, what's on the platform for this election coming up?
Yes, the topics that they had were on education, on providing more resources and material and qualified teachers to the outer islands. also reducing the home loans for first buyers here in the Cook Islands. They also express quite a bit of interest in the environment sector and seeing waste management improve and reducing the use of plastics and polystyrene.
Okay, and sort of, did they see their, clearly they're the future of the Cook Islands, did they see their future in the Cook Islands? Because of course, there's been a lot of debate, hasn't there, about the out-migration and stuff?
Yeah. The participants that were there, they did raise the issue of outward migration as well. And there was a little bit of discussion about how we could, you know, prompt more people to stay. I think for them, providing these types of forums, for them to be able to engage in these sorts of things where they can see, you know, a brighter future for them is quite empowering.
And, of course, a number of the actual members of parliament were there too. Do you reckon they had their eyes opened?
Yeah, for sure. There were some interesting questions directed at a couple of them in particular, you know, about what they had planned to do for the youth. Some personal questions also were aimed at them.
They didn't hold back at all, did they?
No, they didn't hold back. You know, of course, we live in a small community over here, so you have some people running against members of their own family and stuff, and then when you hear them talking about family ties and that being important, and then they're questioning whether, okay, we see that you value those things, but then you're running against members of your own family. Like, how does that feel for you? Those were the sorts of questions that were coming through from the youth, which was like, oh, interesting. We're all thinking it, you know, as facilitators, but we don't want to ask it.
Yikes. Okay. How old would the youngest member of parliament be?
I'd say maybe late 30s.
Okay, so not too bad. I'm just sort of thinking, is there that big of a gulf between, you know, the MPs and the youth? Because here, a big thing is a lot of the MPs are sort of in their 50s and 60s, and that's being shown as a reason, a possibility of why youth struggle to engage with politics. Is it similar there?
Oh, yes, certainly. I think it's also kind of, ministers are kind of held on a place on a high pedestal over here, and these are sorts of things that the elders do, or the, you know, that's the kind of culture over here that is embraced, that, you know, that's for the older people. It's not necessarily something that we can get involved in, but I think that, you know, by us being able to take them through these trainings, they're kind of a bit more confident in saying that, oh, no, this is something that we can get involved. It is, I think we try to encourage the conversation around the decisions that they make ultimately affect their life.
And, of course, you've got an election campaign going on right now, I guess.
Yeah.
Are youth particularly interested or involved?
Kind of hard not to be over here in the Cook Islands, because you're most likely related to someone who is running for the election.
Got to put up some posters for your uncle, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Or help with the kaikai, you know, the food making, you know, with everyone coming, you know, the campaigning. So, but another message that resonated amongst the youth was the fact that, you know, they don't have to necessarily vote for their family member or for the party that their family, you know, are strongly for, because we have very, very strong party affiliations here in the Cook Islands with the families. But just, you know, actually analysing, you know, there's these things called manifestos that, which, you know, they didn't even know about, the promises that these certain parties say that they're going to do for you. Have a read through them, see whether you like them, see whether there are gaps in there that you need to be, you know, and that you need to think about, you know, to ask them about. And based on that, make your decisions.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from the studios of PCJ Radio International. The Papua New Guinea Institute of National Affairs says ultimate responsibility over who gets royalty payments from resource projects rests with the government. Many of the landowners in the areas affected by the enormous ExxonMobil liquefied natural gas project are yet to receive any royalties. That's 4 years after the plant went into operation. The companies involved and members of the government have been trading barbs about who is responsible for the failure, which is fostering tensions in several provinces. The INA's executive director, Paul Baker, says that while the development is obligated to do social mapping to identify the right landowners before the project starts, it is up to the government to complete this process.
The government is responsible for the Petroleum and Gas Act, and the Minister for Petroleum, he is basically responsible for the legislation. He's responsible for determining the beneficiaries. So he only receives the social mapping that, and landowner identification work that's provided by the petroleum companies concerned, whether it's for exploration or development licenses and so on. He receives that. He then determines who the landowners actually are, and then invites those landowners to the development forum process, and then negotiates with those landowners the benefit package that basically is the component that's incorporated in the agreement. So, yeah, basically the responsibility to make sure that everything has been done lies with the minister, that's for sure. And prior to issuing of licenses, the minister would have to have made sure that the respective companies have actually done their work. So sometimes it's a case of, yeah, the pressure and the speed to get on with things comes from the government side. Obviously, the companies want to get on with things themselves, but the direction does come from the minister.
In this particular case, it does seem like there was haste coming from the companies and I guess from the government as well.
Well, the government was wanting to progress with a major project. If you remember, there was a long expectation for a gas pipeline to Queensland to go ahead, and that was perceived to be a future long-term revenue source for the state. And when that didn't happen, when the LNG market seemed to be developing and the prospects of development, there was a strong presentation by industry that there was a narrow slot that PNG would be able to get into supplying the East Asian market and needed to move rapidly. So the government was very keen for that to go ahead, as were some of the participating companies, Oil Search, and then of course they were sort of encouraging Exxon to be fully engaged and to take over a lot of the steerage of this whole project. And then when Exxon did agree to that, and obviously when they made the decision to do so, then again it was a case of a timeline and moving ahead. So they probably hadn't got a lot of experience with PNG as some of the other companies like Oil Search did have, but they were going to be guided, of course, to a large extent by their partners and by the government of PNG, as well as being, of course, at the end of the day, directed by the government of PNG.
The critical thing, I guess, for PNG at this point is that it needs to get royalty payments to the legitimate landowners, and it needs to do it quickly. How easily can the government agencies involved sort out just who are legitimate landowners?
That legally should have been clearly done in advance. The companies highlight that they've made the funds available through to the government agencies for that purpose, but then this delay over who the legitimate landowners are. Obviously, a whole series of landowners and LLG, local level governments, etc., all participated in that beneficial ownership meeting that occurred in East New Britain back in the end of the last decade, beginning of this decade, and all the identification should have really occurred by then. But clearly there were disputes over who the legitimate owners were, suggestions that some who were not legitimate participated in that benefit-sharing meeting, and others who felt that they were left out of that process. So as a result of that, you've had a whole exercise of, in a way, retroactive landowner identification that's been going on, both through administrative processes and through judicial processes. But that's clearly been taking a considerable period of time. In the meantime, the landowners on the ground, the construction phase was going on. Benefits were occurring to contractors. Many landowner companies were engaged. A lot of work and income was getting distributed through the community. Then they moved from the construction to the production phase. Obviously, those companies were progressively laid off and limited business income earning opportunities available on the ground. And yet production was going on, and the landowners would have seen that, you know, someone was clearly getting income from the operations. And then, of course, this was then brought to head with issues associated with, most recently, of course, the earthquake and all the associated damage. And that added to the levels of frustration, and there was a level of conflict that was building up, and demands were being laid on the government and the companies. They're applying the pressure, and of course the government and of course everyone is keen to make sure that, and the court system are keen to make sure it's the genuine landowners that are identified, which means that you have to make sure that your homework has been done correctly, otherwise you're going to, in a way, add to the frustration rather than subtract from it if the wrong landowners receive the royalty payments. So the pressure is on to do it properly, but unfortunately you've got this multiple system with the judicial type processes going on at the same time as you've got the more anthropological landowner identification, and unfortunately the two sides don't seem to be recognizing each other, which is adding a bit to the level of delays and frustration.
A Marshall Islands poet and climate change advocate is highlighting the connection to nuclear waste and the ongoing impact in her community. Kathy Gentle-Kinnear says a report recently indicated there was just over 30 years left now before the low-lying atolls start to become uninhabitable. She spoke to Sarah Vietula about three of her favorite poems that discuss the intersection between climate change and nuclear waste and explore themes such as land loss, health problems, and what the future is shaping up to be like for their children.
Sometimes I wonder if Marshallese women are the chosen ones. If someone selected us out from a stack, drew us out slow, methodical, then issued the order. Give birth to nightmares. Show the world what happens when the sun explodes inside you. How many stories of nuclear war are hidden in our bodies? 574. The number of stillbirths and miscarriages after the bombs of 1951, before the bombs, 52.
I've been writing a lot more about nuclear testing, and a piece that I worked on recently that I'm proud of personally is a poem called Monster that links the nuclear-radiated affected birth defects, the birth defects that Marshallese women suffered from due to the nuclear weapons testing program that was conducted by the U.S. after World War II. So it connected those birth defects with a Marshallese woman demon and also my own experiences of postpartum. And so it can seem sort of convoluted, this connection between the three.
Dear Matafele Benu, you are a seven-month-old sunrise of gummy smiles. You are bald as an egg and bald as the Buddha. Your thighs that are thunder, shrieks that are lightning, so excited for bananas, hugs, and our morning walks along the lagoon. Dear Matafele Benu, I want to tell you about that lagoon, that lucid, sleepy lagoon.
I'm also proud of the piece that I wrote for the United Nations, obviously, because it's my most hopeful piece. And I think every time that I get asked to perform that piece quite often. And, you know, sometimes it does get sort of frustrating, you know, to constantly do the same poem over and over. And yet I also appreciate it because it's my most hopeful piece. And so every time I do it, I feel as though I'm calling it into reality. I'm calling it into being, you know, that there's lines in it that are so almost too hopeful, like almost ridiculously optimistic. You know, no one's drowning, baby. No one's losing their homeland. No one's going to become a climate change refugee. Every time I say that over and over, I'm speaking it into being, you know, and I think this is a belief. That's why I love spoken word. You know, I see some similarities to our traditional culture, our traditional beliefs in the power of orality, in the power of the spoken word to create and shape the reality around us. Yeah.
I'm coming to meet you. I'm coming to see you. What stories will I find? Will I find an island or a tomb? To get to this tomb, take a canoe. Take a canoe through miles of scattered sun. Swallow endless swirling sea. Gulp down radioactive lagoon. Do not bring flowers or speeches. There will be no white stones to scatter along this grave. There will be no songs to sing. How shall we remember you?
I did see a piece recently on YouTube. So you visited that dome.
Yes.
What was that like for you?
It was amazing. It was It was probably one of the most impactful journeys I've ever taken, and I learned so much from it. We ended up taking this canoe, which is a canoe that's been given to us from the Okeanos Foundation. So it's not a traditional Marshallese canoe. It's actually a Polynesian-style canoe, but it's a sustainable form of transportation. It was definitely an experience, you know, but it made the journey all the more meaningful because when we got there, it was like, wow, land. You know, I understood the meaning of seeing land in a completely new light. And so we got there to Eniwetok, and what we did was we met with the community. We performed a lot of the ceremonies that you're supposed to do when you go into the outer island. You know, you meet and you have dinner, and there's speeches that are given and gifts that are given. And so we gave school supplies to the students out there, and I conducted a poetry workshop. And then after, you know, interviewing and talking to more people about Runit, that's the name of the dome, this nuclear waste site, we then journeyed to that nuclear waste site, which is about 15 miles away from the island that the community is actually living on. So we did the poem video, we shot the poem video, and then after that we journeyed to Biginni, which is another site of the nuclear weapons testing program. That was a 2.5-day journey. And then after Biginni, that was a 5-day journey from Biginni to Mejiro, back to the center. And so Dome is this massive nuclear waste site that was left from the U.S. weapons testing program. So what they did was they tested 43 nuclear weapons in Eniwetok Atoll. And then they took all of the radioactive waste from those tests and they ground it into a concrete slurry and filled this crater on Runit Island and capped it with some concrete. And that's the nuclear waste that's there to this day. And it's massive. It's huge. And so it's always kind of captured my imagination. I mean, just like with climate change, nuclear testing has so many stories and it's complicated and complex. And Runit was this monstrosity, this horrific tragedy that has always captured my imagination. And I've always wondered what would it be like to go there and to see it for myself? You know, what kinds of conversations and what kinds of stories would arise from being there?
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you wish to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.